listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Guys, welcome back to the Tennis.com podcast. This is Ed McGrogan catching up again with Steve Tigner after a little bit of a break, but this is certainly the right time to get back chatting about the game. It's a turning point from the hard court stretch to the clay, with Miami just behind us now, Indian Wells just before that. But before we really get into any of those long-term talks, Steve, it's really a pretty interesting weekend to go over from Miami, considering that the two world number ones won the title. And on the face value, you might think that there's, you know, what more is there to say really about Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams? But, you know, I think their matches and the way they played, you know, sort of like Federer was when he was winning, and all these really these great number ones, they give us something to talk about every time.
Yeah, you know, Djokovic, it's, you know, it used to be that you talk about the Indian Wells, Miami double is one of the tougher things to do, is, you know, sort of equal of a winning a Grand Slam. But Djokovic, you know, you'd almost expect it from him now. He's done it three times, the first player to do that. He's done it 2 years in a row. He was definitely challenged at this tournament, but there's nobody, you know, right now. You know, he beat Federer in Indian Wells, he beat Murray in Miami. Rafa is probably not where he wants to be at the moment. You know, Djokovic is, you know, he's won Australia, he's won these two. So he's alone at the top, and the same for Serena. You know, I don't know if I can remember a time when Serena was so far ahead, and, you know, in any given moment, so far ahead of the rest of the women's tour. She's always been the player to beat, but right now, you know, the only other player who had a good sort of last month was Simona Halep, who definitely challenged her in Miami. I don't know if you can, I'm not ready to call her a rival of Serena's, but you know, everybody else seems to be stagnating a little, and Serena, you know, keeps going forward. I just realized this weekend that since the start of 2012, she's 236-12, which if she can, you know, if that would give her the highest, that's higher winning percentage than anybody's ever had in there for a complete career, obviously, and probably up there with any 4 year period anyone's ever had.
Yeah, and you had some good remarks, I think, in your report about Serena, comparing her at this stage of her career to where she was 10 years ago, and her saying, you know, that she was pretty good back then too. It's really a career that, you know, obviously is going to be in the record books forever, and is going to be one that will probably, you know, like most things, kind of appreciate more as time passes along. I think you could say that for both of these champions here. And, you know, when you raise the question, or really made the statement, that, you know, Serena at 33 is as far ahead of the WTA field as she's ever been, you know, I got thinking about that again yesterday. You know, how far ahead is Novak Djokovic? You know, it's not to the same degree, but is he as far ahead of the ATP field as he has ever been in his career? You know, the gap certainly is different between the two. I don't think anybody would say otherwise, but, you know, is Djokovic really at kind of the absolute height of his powers thus far, and, you know, everyone else is certainly farther off than they've been?
It does seem to be. You know, Federer said that Djokovic is in his absolute prime. He said that in Indian Wells. And
I thought that was quite an admission, actually.
Djokovic didn't disagree with that. He said he's in his prime now. He's going to turn 28 next month. You know, we've seen with Federer and Nadal, that can be the start of, you know, that can be the end of their prime. That can, you know, sort of start to be the beginning when we start to see some, you know, see some them lose some matches they hadn't lost in the past. But you know, you don't really imagine that happening to Djokovic within the next year. Like he's as strong physically, obviously, as he's ever been. He, you know, even though this is one of the more physical months, there was nobody younger who really came along and showed that he's in better shape, or showed that Djokovic might be possibly getting old. You know, Djokovic is as is sort of as solid as he's ever been. And I think that's true. I think he's about as, you know, Federer is there with him. Federer's beaten him this year. But Federer's also older. There's nobody Novak's age, Murray and Rafa right now who are really there with Djokovic at the top of the game.
And I guess the only real negative you might be able to derive from all that is that, you know, with another astoundingly good spring and, you know, really winter of success for Djokovic, you know, remember he, you know, even dating back to last year, he won the World Tour Finals. He won the previous Masters before that in Paris. The only thing it does that, you know, could be perceived as something of a negative is that it just only intensifies the pressure on him to really get it done this clay season, to get the French Open title that eludes him, to get the career slam. And then I think the perception is that once that is sort of freed off him, I mean, a lot of people, you know, not that Djokovic has ever been held back by anything before, but, you know, if it's possible to make Djokovic even looser and more dangerous as a player, you know, that could even be it there. But I do think the point is that, you know, as great as Djokovic is being as a number one, he's obviously very comfortable at the top. I think that is a, you know, the ability to stay in the top ranking and still play your game and still play it the way you've been able to. You know, not every tennis player has shown they can do that. He's managed to not only get to number one, but he's managed to hold it down and for quite some time now. But I do just wonder if we say this every year going into the clay season with him, because it feels like Djokovic has progressively been gaining on Rafa, but has never been able to pass him at the finish line.
Yeah, I don't know if it's a negative this time. I mean, it's true that probably the last 3 years and probably this year you would make them, right now, you would make them the co-favorites for the French. You know, Rafa is always favored to win the French, but just judged on form, and you have to put Djokovic there with him. I think, I don't know if it's a negative that he's played so well. I think it just comes down to, you know, he'll have some ups and downs over the next couple months before the French Open. It will probably come down to, as it has the last few years, just if he plays Rafa in the French semis or final, does he just believe that he can win that match? You know, that's the one match he's shown that he just doesn't yet quite believe he can win. Is it, you know, would it take somebody else knocking off Nadal the way it did for Federer? We'll see, though. You know, you start to feel like, you do feel like it's inevitable that one of these years he's going to win the French Open.
And the one thing, one other thing I would say to kind of, you know, make sure I really come across as Djokovic has done everything to the best of his ability and has done it fantastically, is that I think this year, you know, he has a full year with his coaching with Boris Becker helping him out. I think the Wimbledon win, of course, these things did not materialize into the comfort that I think we're seeing from him now until he got past that Wimbledon final last year, and I think that will only sort of embolden him and kind of help him along in this journey, you know, in Paris when it comes down to it, because no matter what kind of transpires during this clay season, it seems, you know, the word inevitable that you bring up there, that's really what this will boil down to. This kind of is, you know, as much as the men's tour really over the past, I think, you know, year and a half, 2 years, has developed, you know, another really generation of exciting younger players, and we're still seeing what Federer can do as he's moved into his really close to mid-30s, you know, that sort of inevitable discussion will come to pass, and it's going to be, you know, the story of the tournament to see if Djokovic can answer it, really. So, you know, I think with that, we'll kind of leave our congratulations to Novak, because he really hasn't doesn't have to prove anything, of course, but let's kind of go to the last player he beat, and that's Andy Murray, who kind of got a sort of a rude send-off to his wedding from Novak with a 6-0 third set after after what looked like it could develop into a really pretty nice third set, and that, you know, this is just what happened at the Australian Open, as many people have pointed out, and for many of the past matches between Murray and Djokovic. You know, oddly enough, Murray's only two wins over Djokovic in their last 12 have been the two major titles he's won. But, you know, where do you, I guess, you know, we try to think about things to say with the world number ones. What do you kind of say for Andy Murray now? Because we've heard this story told many times, too.
Yeah, you know, I think most people would be happy with the last month that Murray's had. He made the semis in Indian Wells. He made the final in Miami. He only lost to Djokovic. He's also coming off the Australian final. But at the same time, you know, I think Murray has been in a place where he's, you know, he has been in a better place in the past. You know, he's not like most other players. He's beaten the big three in the past. He's won Grand Slams in the past. And now he still is a step below that. He's 0-12 against Djokovic, Nadal, and Federer since having split back surgery in 2013. So I thought winning this match, if he's ever going to get back to that level where he was, winning this match would have been a step in that direction. And he did play well, but it ended up being the same problem, not just with beating Djokovic, but I felt like Murray, like at the Australian Open, you know, we always know he can get negative and he's never going to be cheerful on the court, but I felt like it really has hurt him in the Australian Open final and this final, in a sense that he just, you know, you see Djokovic on one side get angry and then let it go, but you see Murray get angry and then continue to be negative or let that affect him for a longer period of time.
It's not a release of that frustration.
Right. I think this tournament this month is good for Murray. He's better in a better place than he was a year ago, but he still has to take a next step if we're going to see him where he was in 2000, you know, before 2013.
Yeah, and as we run back toward the Novak Djokovic casualty list, the man before that, John Isner. This match, I feel like we've seen it's either in Indian Wells or Miami or Cincinnati. These two have tended to collide in the past in these later rounds here. Isner has won a couple of them. He beat Djokovic at Indian Wells 3 years ago. He beat Djokovic in Cincinnati, I believe, 2 years ago. It was not to be this time. Djokovic just, you know, his best shot, the return, you know, just fantastic against, you know, I think pretty much the best server in the game. For Isner, you know, you wrote a little about this, about really kind of a complete turnaround after a very poor start to the year, in particular his run in Davis Cup. You know, for Isner, I before the match with Djokovic, I was almost thinking that if he were somehow to get through Djokovic, that I would, you know, I think that frees him a lot. He could have played Murray. I think that could have almost been considered perhaps the biggest U.S. win since the Roddick days. But for Isner overall, I mean, you can't by any means complain about a semifinal run at this event after a nice run to Indian Wells. And, you know, we're never going to put Isner in these discussions of the players that we've been talking about for the first 14 minutes of this podcast, but as he gets toward 30 years old, which is happening very soon, you know, this was a really nice run for him too.
Yeah, I think we're back on an upswing for Isner. Every couple of years, maybe every year, this happens at some point where he shows a lot.
His weapon is too potent to not make an impact at some point. Right.
He's usually, you know, usually happens in the U.S., usually happens when it's 2 out of 3 sets rather than 3 out of 5. But that, you know, this is when he does his damage and And, you know, it's good to see him. He, you know, it seems like he's positive at the moment. He says and acts like he knows how he wants to play. He's just sort of more relaxed and just sort of swinging away and trying to use what he does well, which is to power the ball past the guy, past the other guy, and not have to run a lot. But I think even beyond the results, the way he talked about, you know, where he is and how he's feeling going forward and how he feels about his own game, he seemed a little more sure of himself than we've seen in the past. I think, you know, now he'll have to go to Europe and we'll see what he does in the Grand Slams when it's 3 out of 5, sorry. I do feel like this run could last, you know, a little longer than what we've seen from him in the past.
With that, I think we could turn over to toward the women's side of Miami here, the game itself. And what we saw, as we said, Serena, of course, taking this title, not an unfamiliar title by any means, 8th Miami title, coming off of a withdrawal in Indian Wells. She actually, she gets the semifinal that we didn't see in Indian Wells against Simona Halep. But even so, I think the point you made really about the distance between Serena and the field is one that I found really the most interesting takeaway from this weekend, and how, you know, Serena coming off, you would have to say she would be considered vulnerable in whatever degree you want to call that, if she pulls out of an event a week before, but proceeds to go through this tournament, you know, obviously unbeaten, and that is, as we say, to take nothing away from her, but I think we also have some thoughts, perhaps questions, really about really the rest of the field. I think Simona Halep we can exclude from that discussion, maybe, but maybe not. I think you were a little bit, you had some thoughts about her as well, but really the meat of the competition for Serena in the top 10. A number of these players came into 2015, I think, with a lot of expectation, ranging from Petra Kvitova, I think it was, you know, the biggest potential, had the biggest potential for growth this year. Wozniacki had a really nice start. Ivanovic finished in the top 5 last year. Bouchard had a great season. Radwanska, new coach in Navratilova. It goes on and on. You can almost find sort of disappointment with the play of the rest of the field here, and maybe that's where we should start with the women's discussion.
Yeah, that's one thing to say. One reason I would say that Serena's farther ahead. Not only is she playing well, but everybody else seems to be stagnating at the moment. Sharapova had a good Australian Open, but now she's had a bad spring. Radwanska's down to number 9. She's basically 500 for the year. Bouchard is getting used to a new coach. She's had some injuries. She hasn't done much. Wozniacki won a small tournament, but hasn't had good results at the bigger events. Anna Ivanovic is definitely in a slump this year. And as you said, Kvitova didn't play either of these two tournaments. So, you know, I don't know what that, I would assume that that's going to change, and some of these players will straighten things out. You know, like you said, there's new coaches involved in a lot of these situations. But you also wonder and Halep is somebody who seems ready to challenge Serena, who has seems to have a turnaround after the Australian Open in her attitude and sort of her determination. And she's also good on clay, so she'll be somebody to watch. But
I was going to add that, yeah, the fact that, you know, so many of these players that we've mentioned, I think, have very good clay court credentials. I think that will, I think this change of surface is very opportune, and you know, I think that could be sort of the fuel that kind of gets a lot of these women going back to where we believe they should be.
Yeah, I hope that's true. I think that's also true for Azarenka, who is somebody who can challenge Serena. Her not being there is a big deal at the moment. I do think she'll continue to get better and get herself back into the top 5. But I've been a little bit surprised that she hasn't done better so far this year. But I guess, you know, with like Djokovic, with Serena, you sort of wonder what younger player is ever going to come along to beat them, not even knock them off, but what younger player is going to come along to really seriously challenge them. It's hard to imagine with on either tour right now somebody to see anybody younger who will offer a serious challenge to Serena or Djokovic.
Yeah, I think a good way to back that up is you consider that of the top, I would say of the WTA's most impressive players over the first 4 months of the year, you know, two of the top five have to be Serena Williams and Venus Williams because of and 33 and 34 years of age. So it really has been a continuation instead of a change from what we've seen before. Carla Suarez Navarro, the finalist who we haven't brought up yet, she makes her way, with the finalist run here, gets in the top 10. This is, not exactly, one of the rising stars of the tour. It's really someone who I think through a lot of persistence has belted her way in there. You know, the person she beat to even get to the final was Andrea Pekovic, who took out Karolina Pliskova in the round before that. So, a lot of this tournament, if you kind of dig through the draw, is really many of the young talents who I think for good reason we have discussed while we talk about the women's game over the past year. It could certainly just be this tournament. I think Miami is always going to be a tough one to break through at because of the history of it involving the Williamses, of course. But as you say, as the younger players really didn't kind of come through in this event, and really at this moment we can't really see when they will. Is a good run for the old guard, of course.
Yeah, I think with both sides right now, you don't want to start talking about who's going to win the calendar year Grand Slam, but Djokovic and Serena are in. Each of them won Australia, obviously. That's not a ridiculous thing to think, just in part because of the lack of having a number of challengers around them at the moment.
Yeah, and you would also say that the French should be the hardest. Well, you would consider the French to be the hardest step for both of them. So we will, we'll see where things, where the dust settles really after that event. But, after that point, I think you will see that discussion if either of those happenings come to pass there. I think we'll kind of wave goodbye to the hard court season. Steve, you will have some grades really for the past month in Indian Wells and Miami. I think most of you can surmise who we'll be seeing at the top of that list. You may have forgotten some that will be at the bottom of that list because in this discussion we just not a good showing in Miami, Indian Wells, but it'll be all in Steve's report card, which will be coming out very shortly on tennis.com. I suggest you check that out and everything else coming forward in the next couple of weeks as we make our way to the clay. So, Steve, thank you. We'll get back together next Monday on the tennis.com podcast.
You've been enjoying the tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.